it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name is Chip Berlay. I'm an investigative reporter and independent scholar, and I've been studying and writing about the U.S. political right for over 40 years. And I would have wished to have retired into gardening, but apparently the U.S. political right is here to stay for quite a bit longer.
And tell us the name of your book that's coming out, or it's already out right now.
It's out now. The book I edited is called Trumping Democracy, From Reagan to Alt-Right. It's a collection of essays that were written between roughly 1980 and last year. And what it shows is, even from 1980 forward, the path of what has led to the Trump administration was completely predictable. And a lot of people who were alternative and left and progressive journalists knew that and wrote about it. But the mainstream media kept calling us, hand-wringers.
We're going to talk about a lot of big picture stuff. Obviously there's a lot going on right now, both in terms of the political climate, in terms of the Trump administration itself, in terms of possibilities for social movements, and also what's going to happen to these collections of far-right groups as we go into this real crisis. And, as I was getting ready for this interview, there was a story that came out about how the EPA now has basically just allowed any sort of industry to forego any sort of regulation. Like, the EPA just said, like, we're not going to enforce any sort of regulation, which I think if this was happening at any other time, probably would have gotten more media attention. But, in today's world, it just kind of seems like another, out there thing that's happened in today's, news feed. And I'm just curious, kind of with that craziness in mind, how would you describe the Trump administration right now? Is it stable? I feel like when Trump came in, a lot of liberals were saying things like, oh, he's not going to last. Like, the deep state will have him out within a couple months. And of course, that hasn't happened. And I think as we've seen, as time has gone on, there's obviously a lot of elite forces that do like Trump and are giving money to him and want him in there. So I'm just curious, now that some time has passed, like, how would you describe the Trump administration in political terms?
The Trump administration planning was started in the 1960s after the failure of the Goldwater campaign for president in 1964. And some of us did track it from that period forward to going back to a grassroots kind of mobilizing and organizing style, along with elite training and meetings. And so you had both the building of a grassroots political movement and elite groups meeting to talk about, how to take America back from the lefties and from the socialists and the communists.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting reading, I don't know if you read Bob Woodward's book, Fear, that came out, I think, maybe about a year ago. But it was talking about how Jeff Sessions had maybe a couple years before Trump's campaign had written an essay about how somebody from a populist perspective could utilize anger over immigration to win the presidency, much like George Wallace used anger over integration to basically rise to power. I don't know, it's interesting that they were, like you were saying, they were predicting that stuff, before obviously Trump came in.
So if you look at the various campaigns, the Goldwater campaign, the Wallace campaign. There was a lot of people looking at how to rebuild a grassroots movement on the right after the failure of the Goldwater presidential campaign in 1964. And that's really the birth of the new right, was the people like Phyllis Schlafly and Weyrich and all sorts of other people involved in the failure of that campaign. And the goal then was to say, how do we take the presidency? What will it take for us to do for that to happen? And there were all of these movement right-wing think tanks and study centers and organizing centers that were set up, really as early as the Goldwater campaign, but really blossoming into what became known as the New Right. And that's, the New Right is what elected Reagan president in 1980. But they didn't go away as a mobilizing force. You know, when Reagan won the presidency, the right-wing populist and right-wing industrial and right-wing organizational elites kept building these grassroots organizations in the form of think tanks, in the form of newspapers and newsletters, and when the web started to grow, building an online web presence. In the meantime, the Democratic Party did everything it could to shove the activists and the socialists out of the center of the party.
Yeah, there's actually a really good book. It's called Suburban Warriors, The Origins of the New American Right. Just real quick, I feel like on this podcast, we've talked about figures like Barry Goldwater and George Wallace. But if you can just describe for people, I mean, especially for younger people, these names are kind of so far in the past. Why are they important in this construction of a movement you call the New American Right or the New Right? If you can kind of flesh that out. Because I also like Barry Goldwater is very connected to what's termed the Southern Strategy. If you can just kind of flesh this out for people real quick.
That's a challenge. Well, let me try. The Goldwater campaign crashed and burned. It was a really low voter turnout for Goldwater. And what you have coming out of that was a decision by a lot of people who had worked on the Goldwater campaign, people like Phyllis Schlafly and Paul Weyrich, who were icons of the organizational movement, right? And they basically decided to rebuild a grassroots network of think tanks and newsletters and newspapers and projects at colleges, at the same time that the Democratic Party, after the McGovern campaign, began to withdraw support from the same kinds of things. So as the Republican Party began to align itself with grassroots organizational movements, the Democratic Party, based in Washington, D.C., and the DNC, basically withdrew all of the grassroots kind of work other than voter get-out drives. And that was critical in allowing them to be forced out of office and for the rise of people like Donald Trump.
Yeah, thanks for going over that. Well, just going back to Trump now, would you say that there's been major changes in the administration just in terms of how it operates since he first came into power? Obviously, there's been a lot of people that have come and gone. But in terms of, you know, a political machine, has Trump or the administration really took a severe turn in a different direction since he's come into power? Or has it pretty much stayed on the same course?
Well, Trump was swept into office with a very tight-knit organizational structure and group of people around him. And as soon as he got into the presidency, the mainstream Republican activists and organizers began to peel those people away and really try and build a ladder for him to climb up into traditional right-wing, you know, Reagan-esque kinds of policies and away from the more populist organizations that had helped get him into the presidency. And that's been a struggle ever since. And you see that now with, you know, Trump just not being able to deal with the crisis that we're in with the coronavirus. He's lost a lot of the people who helped him get into office. And now he's surrounded by a bunch of party hacks and organizational thugs who basically want to use his administration as a kind of bank account to empty out for their own personal private profit and benefit.
How about the relationship between the far right and the Trump administration? Has that changed at all? I mean, we're going to be talking about parts of this further up in the interview, but I'm curious, you know, that interplay between Trump and grassroots far right groups, has that changed since the election?
So there are different sectors of the U.S. political right, and some of them have actually broken from the support for Trump, and others are still embedded in the administration. And so there's this battle that's going on between the right-wing populist and the right-wing grassroots organizers and the traditional big business and machine-oriented Republicans. And you can see that in the kinds of struggles that go on. So it's still in flux. It's not clear who's going to gain the upper hand, except that right now, with the coronavirus dilemma, clearly he's being handled by strategists and inside the Beltway people because he's simply intellectually unable to cope with it.
You know, we just talked about the relationship between the far right and the Trump administration. I'm curious if you can talk also about how this kind of like mirrors what's happened in the past. We've already brought up Barry Goldwater, and I brought up George Wallace. I know in these campaigns that there were segments of the far right, maybe different Klan chapters or even people that are involved in like the American Nazi Party that were involved in these campaigns. I'm curious if you can speak to how what happened in the past in terms of those campaigns and the integration of different far right groups. Does that mirror at all what's happening now, or is it very different?
When you go back and look at some of the earlier campaigns, especially around Reagan, you basically, there's a book called Old Nazis, the New Right in the Republican Party, and there's another one called The Coors Connection, both by Russ Ballant, who worked at Political Research Associates, putting out two books from South End Press. And basically, you can trace the organizational ties from the early days of coming out of the Wallace campaign and going through to the New Republican Party. And one of the most interesting studies I saw was that one of the single biggest predictors of a shift from Southern Democrats to Southern Republicans was whether or not there had been an active Klan chapter in that county during that period. And so what you see is a lot of people who are active in the Klan in the 60s getting active in the Republican Party in the late 70s and the early 80s. So there's definitely a relationship. How many of the actual people actually got absorbed in the Republican Party can be examined at some close range with scholarly studies. But the bottom line is that the Republican Party shifted far to the right and was basically brought into this, you know, what's been called a network started, you know, by people like Paul Weyrich and the Coors Foundation, and then going on to a number of other organizations and families and like the Koch brothers. So you've had this elite group. They actually have a meeting every year called the Council for National Policy, where all of these mega bucks, right wingers and the political strategists and the candidates get together and basically talk about their strategy for the coming year. And that hasn't gotten enough attention. So we're still watching the organizational networks that were founded in the Wallace campaign, which was a Democratic Party campaign, and then the right wing of the Republican Party sort of morphing out of Klan-oriented and racist-oriented white political activists in the South, which were shut out of the Republican Party briefly, but then came back in under Trump.
Yeah, I always think it's really important to remember, and we were lucky enough to have Leonard Zeskin on here to talk about his book, Blood and Politics. But, you know, groups like the National Vanguard, that actually grew out of the George Wallace
exactly,
campaign.
Exactly, an electoral campaign, right.
Well, I want to turn now, and last year there was a bombshell that was released by the Southern Poverty Law Center that showed that Stephen Miller, who is one of Trump's chief advisors, and you know, 10 years ago when he was going to Duke University, he was working with Richard Spencer to organize speaking events for people like Brimlow, come speak on campus. And then, you know, fast forward to 2015, in the lead up to the Trump administration, he's working with Breitbart and like funneling them articles from American Renaissance and VDare and other white nationalist websites to kind of construct the media narratives that would go on to help Trump win the election. You know, that seemed to become definitely a major news story, but at the same time, the scandal itself didn't seem to not land, at least not in the same way that like forced Bannon out of the White House after Charlottesville. Obviously, there's a clear relationship between groups like the Federation for Immigration Reform, FAIR, or Center for Immigration Studies, CIS, Numbers USA, and the Trump administration. I'm just curious on your take about this relationship.
There's a large number of right-wing foundations that focus on topics such as stopping immigration from people that they don't like, basically closing the borders, eradicating the Environmental Protection Agency. There's a whole range of these think tanks that are very, very well funded, and they tend to operate very differently from the groups funded by the Democratic Party and the political left among funders. And it's really a shame that so much of what was early on the evidence that the right wing was building an integrated network from top to bottom, at the same time that the Democratic Party was squeezing out the McGovernites and the lefties from the party. And so what you have then was a grassroots mobilizing effort on behalf of right wing Republicans, while the Democrats were focusing on, you know, making neoliberalism palatable to the left, which it will never be.
Is there another example in history in which people that are obviously coming out of the white nationalist right have taken up such a position in terms of advising policy? It seems like this is unparalleled, somebody like Stephen Miller coming out of that subculture.
It's complicated. That's the word you'll hear very often from me. So after the turn of the, well, there's two turns of the centuries now. Early in the 1900s, all the way up through the 1920s, you could have people from the Ku Klux Klan invited to march in Washington, to be invited to the White House for, you know, showings of racist films in the White House. So that this is not new in terms of the racism and white nationalism. What's new is that following the civil rights period and the civil rights movement, this became unacceptable. And what we see under the Trump administration, first sort of really in the back corridors of the Republican Party, the resuscitation of, you know, literally former Nazis from World War II becoming integrated into the Republican Party reelection campaigns, which was what the book Old Nazis, The New Right in the Republican Party by Russ Ballant was about. But now under Trump, you see that these same forces, a newer generation, are being brought into the Trump administration. So you have rabidly nativist, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, laissez-faire populism, which is really bizarre. It's all woven together into this matrix that helps keep Trump in office and will be used in the upcoming political campaigns in a very complex sly set of ways, where there will be people who claim they have no connection to the Trump or Republican Party apparatus, stepping outside what's acceptable, allowing the Republicans and the Trump administration to say, well, we're not like them, when in fact, you know, when they step out of the closet of major TV coverage, they actually are very much on the same page, including all forms of racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, and authoritarianism.
Yeah, talking about FAIR, that brings us to our next topic. You know, Chris Kobach, I really feel this is another figure that has not really kind of got enough pushback, obviously, against him. He's somebody that comes out of FAIR's legal arm, and in beyond going into politics, obviously, he's really worked with Trump and other Republican figures to spearhead this voter ID check, which is, we've talked to people like Greg Paulist on this podcast about how they've kind of like streamlined a system which has kicked millions of people, especially voters of color, off the roll or off the voting rolls just systematically, which has had a huge impact, of course, politically. I'm just curious, like, again, like, how does a figure like this kind of like fly under the radar? It seems like obviously a lot of people know who this guy is, but I just feel like there's not enough, attention or anger kind of directed at these people.
I think most Americans, if they knew the background of some of these people that was described in mainstream media, corporate media, they would be appalled and repelled and be pushing back. But for the most part, the corporate media has stepped away from its role as investigative journalism and really just started being a carrier wave for advertising and promotion of favored people and products and parties. So it's dismal now. There's very little serious investigative reporting on the rise of the right within the Trump administration. And even when it was the election coming up, you could see who he was surrounding himself with. And really, for the most part, the mainstream corporate press failed miserably to predict where it would be going. And it's not like there weren't books and programs talking about where this was going to end up, because there were.
Yeah, speaking of relationships with the far right, I think another one in terms of like a grassroots quote-unquote organization is the Proud Boys. And over the past couple of years, there's been several GOP figures that have developed relationships with them, or people like Tucker Carlson or other people. There was one quote I think that really stands out. There was when the Proud Boys marched at a Trump campaign rally. I think this is maybe last summer. I believe it was in Florida, and there was a New York Times reporter, and he was quoting some GOP insider asking him about the Proud Boys at the Trump rally. And the GOP person said, "Yeah, it's like an open coalition that we can't talk about."
And it was really stupid, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but that in itself is, you know, I think is shocking to a lot of people. But yet, you know, they continue to show up at rallies. I mean, obviously they have a relationship with people like Roger Stone. So I'm just curious if you can speak to this. I mean, what does this say about the present moment?
The Republican Party on both the national and the state level now is packed with racists and anti-gay activists and Christian right evangelical apocalyptics who, you know, really don't mind if the world ends because they'll all be okay. And it's really not reported on in any serious depth. And to a certain extent, I've been repeatedly told by mainstream journalists, both print and electronic media, that they can't really quote some of the things I'm saying to them because their editors wouldn't allow it because it would be seen as too partisan. Now, to me, that's kind of surrealistic, but it's where we are now. If you can listen to Tucker Carlson's work over the last couple of years and not see that he does not belong on any major media in the United States, he's really unsuitable. It's not journalism, it's propaganda. And so we are now in a phase where the mainstream media is incapable of doing the kind of research and reporting that would expose what's happening in the Trump administration among his advisors and activists and supporters that are built on racism, sexism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia. All of these words should be in the paper every single day, and they're not.
Yeah, let's talk about Fox News for a second. You brought up Tucker Carlson. I'm just curious, you know, where do you see that whole engine going in the coming terrain? We're going to talk about, you know, Trump's reelection campaign in a bit, but I'm just curious, like, if you think of, you know, where Fox News will be in the next couple years, like, do you see it kind of like doubling down on this kind of like, you know, some sort of mutant version of white nationalism or far-right populism? Or is it going to kind of like ebb away and go back to maybe some sort of neoconservatism, or kind of like be a home for both?
Fox News is like the canaries in the coal mine, and the canaries have been dead for a while, so that basically Fox News can drift more towards a kind of xenophobic and vicious kind of stance or move to a more moderate stance, and yet they'll still be telling the same story, is that straight white American men are under attack in the United States, and people who are brown-skinned and not white nationalists from around the world are never our ally, they're always our enemy. In three nations now, you have racial nationalist parties in power. There are in Russia, in the United States, and in India. And this racial nationalism is leading to attacks on people who don't fit in based on this racial nationalist idea of who are the real people. And what we're going to see over the next year is whether or not the Trump administration and the Fox News people are going to move more towards acclimating the U.S. to that being the new reality of racialist, white nationalist Christianity or religion of any sort, or they're going to have to come to grips with the fact that the United States is descending into chaos and a vicious kind of racial nationalist Christianity.
COVID-19 has exposed the many failings of states around the globe. Millions have lost their jobs, leaving many unable to pay rent and in danger of eviction. In response, tenants around the world organized rent strikes for April 1. As the crisis continues, even more people will fall short of rent. More rent strikes will begin May 1 and maybe even June 1. If you're worried about making rent now or in the future, it's time to get organized. Reach out to your neighbors, find your local tenants union, and let the landlords know you won't be paying rent. Then fly a white sheet from your window to spread the message. Channel Zero Network podcasts have put out several episodes on tenant struggles surrounding COVID-19. Check out Rebel Steps' emergency rent strike episode for ways to get started. It's Going Down's episode This Is America, number 111 and 112 for interviews with organizers. And the Final Straws episode, Doing for Selves, to hear from Tenants United in Chicago, and Crime Thinks, the Ex-Worker podcast, episode 75, for an overview of rent strike tactics and history. Even though we don't know what the future holds, we do know that stronger communities are the way to ensure a better world for all of us. We can build those communities one person at a time, building by building, block by block. Be ready to join the movement on May 1.
Well, I wanted to turn now and talk about another group, Turning Point USA. There's been a lot of articles that have been written about them over the past couple of years, and obviously Trump has a relationship with Charlie Kirk. I believe Charlie Kirk's father worked for Trump, worked on like a Trump Tower and some other projects. And also people have written about Turning Point USA that are, you know, very much funded by people like the Koch brothers, and they get a lot of funding from different big foundations. I'm just curious, when we think about groups like them, how much are they a construction of elite interests and money, and at the same time, you know, grassroots organizations? Do they kind of like have a foot in both worlds, or are they more just the creation of, you know, moneyed interests on the right?
Any successful political movement in the U.S. has to have grassroots movements, media, and elite formations. And what you're seeing with the Trump administration is a funding of a whole network from top to bottom, integrating this into support for Trump. And, you know, this has been talked about in a number of books, especially about the Koch brothers and groups like the Council for National Policy, which is an elite discussion group. And what's missing is the coverage of this integrated network changing the entire shape of the American political system in terms of elections and policy making. So it's really very difficult to step back and say, wait, this is actually something that was set out as a goal after the Goldwater campaign and was built piece by piece and was reported on every step of the way. And now we're here with the Trump administration and the coronavirus dilemma and the heading into a new election with really vicious kinds of, you know, scuzzballs being brought in to build the election campaign for Trump. And the mainstream media is not at all equipped or not at all willing to deal with any of this.
What do you see happening to formations like the so-called Groypers or Nick Fuentes's followers, and they're trying to basically push the MAGA movement towards open white nationalism, going and like disrupting Turning Point USA events or heckling people like Donald Trump Jr.? And also, what does it mean that people like Michelle Malkin, who have established careers, or at least they did, as kind of conservative commentators, have really put all that on the line to throw their, you know, lot behind them? I'm just curious where you kind of see that whole section of kind of like the neo-alt-right going.
Well, if you look at Michelle Malkin, especially, she helped build the Tea Party movement. And it's basically not a surprise that some of these things were discussed at meetings of the Christian right that I attended in Washington, D.C., and other investigative reporters and journalists and researchers attended. And it was all laid out well in advance, so that what we're going into now is a new electoral cycle where the mainstream media is not going to have the resources or the interest in following up all these connections. These are integrated networks. There are plausible deniability. They do sometimes, the leaders and the researchers of these organizations and the strategists get together in a variety of, off the record fora. And so what we're seeing now is the beginning of knitting together a patchwork quilt of rabid, racist, sexist, homophobic, Islamophobic, anti-Semitic groups into a coalition that's loosely bound, so that you can have Jews for Trump along with an anti-Semitic group for Trump. And this is not seen now as a barrier to supporting him.
So would you argue that now the different kind of factions of the far right are more unified than they were before? Because I think most people would argue that at this point, with Trump being in office a couple years, that things have kind of devolved a little bit. Like the factions are kind of less energized than they were before, especially post-Charlottesville. Maybe this is focusing more on kind of like the street elements than some of the other groups, but I'm curious your take.
Street movements come and go because they're often quite brittle and they have leaders that are really incompetent, but, you know, make a lot of noise, get a lot of people to a rally, but then can't really build an organization. So that's not the measure for me of what's going to be happening. What's the measure is how many people are going to build a coalition to support Trump. We're seeing coalitions being built now that are going to support Trump in the next presidential race. And we're going to see that they are going to bridge some obvious gaps in ideology and methodology for that effort. And then after he gets elected again, which seems probable, we're going to see them once again break apart. Now, this is perfectly normal for political movements and social movements to coalesce around a presidential candidate and then break apart and try and push the policy in a particular direction. So I think that's what's going to happen.
You know, I wanted to turn now. You recently did a speaking event earlier in March titled Why the Far Right Kills. And I think this is another kind of development in this time period right now of these groups like Atomwaffen and that kind of don't see basically either outreach or organizing or even street protests as kind of a way forward and embrace more of a nihilistic, accelerationist kind of politic. And I'm just curious if you can talk a little bit about that event and kind of what the main thrust is and describe why the far right kills.
Not long ago, I spoke at a center for the study of the Yiddish language within Judaism, and it was basically titled Why the Alternative Right Kills. And the answer is it's because the alternative right now smells the possibility that by propaganda of the deed, by actually going out and beating people up and killing people, that they can get enough publicity so they can make a much more larger movement to be built around them who might not be willing to engage in brutalism or murder, but who end up helping move these movements of the right that are vicious and murderous forward, which will then move the Republican Party further to the right. And I think that's a dynamic that you could see, you know, with the left in the 1960s and early 1970s, is that you have a variety of movements that seem to be outside the mainstream political movements and parties, but very much bringing them towards a different understanding of the struggles that were necessary within the Democratic and the Republican Party. So I think it's going to continue. I think that as long as the Trump administration continues to wink and nod at racism and sexism and homophobia and Islamophobia and, you know, destroying the environment for profit, you're going to continue to see little messages sent out, perhaps veiled, to these various movements, which then are reflected back as support for Trump.
Let's say Trump loses in the next election cycle. I know from reading a lot of far-right stuff, just like they said when Trump won and caught them off guard, like I remember very distinctly, and I've said this before, but people like Matthew Parrott from the Traditionalist Worker Party, they said it would have been better if Hillary would have won, because then we would have had some, you know, bad, evil Democrat in office to rally the troops around. Do you think that if Biden wins, that will be kind of better for them in some ways? Or do you think that the Trump staying in office will basically continue the trajectory that we've seen with the far right feeling very emboldened, or are both true?
If Trump wins, then the far right and the accelerationists will continue to put pressure on the state and the political reality to move things towards white nationalism. If Biden wins, they'll do the same thing. They'll just have a different set of rhetoric and a different set of game plans. So these are movements that are not going to go away. It doesn't matter who wins. We're still going to see the racist, sexist, homophobic, Islamophobic, anti-Semitic kind of pushes that are being made in states across the country by these accelerationists, but also by a wide range of other political and social movements who are allied with racist and sexist and homophobic movements.
Well, let's talk now about the coronavirus. How is the far right responding to the coronavirus epidemic? Are they seeing this as an opportunity? And kind of like, what is their strategy within this moment, if there is a strategy?
For the far right, the liberals are creating all the problems, and Trump is trying to make things better, but he's being attacked by these Democratic governors and was basically had his hands tied when he pointed out that it was really the China virus, which was an incredibly nationalistic and racist thing to say. But he got it out, and therefore it did the damage.
Do you see things going in a certain direction as time goes on and this gets worse and the economy continues to crash? Do you think that we'll see an intervention by the far right on the street in a certain way? We've already seen an explosion in like anti-Asian racist attacks and things like that. I'm just curious if you foresee as things within the country just on like a very real material level get worse, if we will see the far right attempt to act in a certain way to gain support.
As the virus continues to expand, I think you're going to see the far right continue to push for racist and xenophobic kinds of policies, but also actions. So that if you're going to be a hero, you need to go out and beat up someone who's Asian or beat up a progressive who's organizing in the streets. It's going to be very hard during this period. And the far right, there's no downside to this for the far right, because no matter how they position themselves, it's going to be blamed on either the liberals and the left attacking Trump or the deep state, which is controlled apparently by the Jews and the Democratic Party, is going to destroy America on behalf of some unknown and idiotic conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I found that interesting. I was watching Alex Jones's speech around the time of CPAC. They did a meeting, and he said, "We're here to, you know, go after the tyrants in Washington, D.C." And it's like, I thought your main man was in Washington, D.C. It's bizarre to watch them kind of like with their administration in power also continue the narrative that they're oppressed, that, still that they are somehow not in control, even though Trump is, you know, heading the executive branch and is issuing all these orders and continues to amass power. It's obviously within part of their playbook, but it's just kind of bizarre to watch play out.
Well, it is bizarre to see a right-wing groups wringing their hands over being swept out of any kind of input into the Trump administration. It's ironic. But that's very true of any social movement. You know, social movements often build political movements. And if their people get elected, one of the first thing the political movement does is throw the social movement people out into the streets again. So that's going to be the dynamic with the right-wing social movements, that they're going to be pushing to either defend or push Trump to the right. But if Trump gets reelected, then they'll be on the outs for a while.
Well, just one last big question. Looking back, it feels like there's been a sort of cooling off period in terms of street mobilizations from the far right. You know, looking back now kind of at the Trump period, you know, obviously like things are still very hot in a lot of ways. But there seems to be a deacceleration on the street aspect of these groups. Like, for instance, we haven't seen a Proud Boys rally in some time, even though they said they were, like, coming back to Portland every month. That hasn't happened.
Yeah, they got beat up.
It seems like it's... Well, in more ways than one, in the eyes of the public, you know, they looked stupid. You know, they were out mobilized by the community. You know, there was a lot of different factors, but I'm just curious, you know, looking back now, do you have any kind of like big analysis in terms of just kind of like what social movements kind of like from below or on the left have done either correctly or, you know, could have done better?
All social movements across the political spectrum have a dynamic relationship with electoral movements and the people in public office. And the more powerful a social movement is, the more likely the mainstream and the political groups are going to move in their direction. So what you're watching now is a right-wing set of movements that now have installed a person that they really hoped would become president in office, but now looking for a second term for the payback, which has come to a certain extent because, you know, Donald Trump is a right-wing oaf. But basically, what's going to happen in the election? How do they present themselves? Are they going to fade away and try and stay low-key for the election so Trump doesn't get tainted with their viciousness and their murderous and injurious activities? Or are they going to double down and see if they can push Trump to the right? Trump's not a very bright guy. My brother went to high school with Donald Trump. He said he wasn't very smart and he was a bully and a jerk. This is at New York Military Academy. So
he could get around with all those bone spurs back then?
Oh, you want to talk about the bone spurs? My brother was the catcher and Trump was the pitcher on some of the baseball teams. You know, the idea that Donald Trump had a bone spur that interfered with him being a pitcher all through high school is not just ludicrous, but literally unbelievable. My brother shipped off to Vietnam. Trump discovered a bone spur. They both were on the same, you know, teams in high school. Anyway, God, we're worrying what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen. I honestly don't know what's going to happen. The coronavirus changes the dynamic dramatically. It will look very bad if Trump continues to mishandle the shortage of information and, you know, devices and technology and drugs. Trump could be buried by the coronavirus if he doesn't get the information, the medication, and the devices out to the hospitals that need it. At the same time, it's entirely possible that the country will be so devastated by the coronavirus that the Republican Party is the only party that has the wherewithal and resources and energy to build a truly powerful electoral campaign. So I can't predict what's going to happen. I can tell you that the right wing has continued to build on the Trump administration as long as it's in office. If Democrats push Trump out of office, they're not going to be the kind of dynamic people who are going to rearrange the hierarchies of power in the U.S. They're going to be rubber stamp Democratic Party yokels who basically, you know, live inside the Beltway and have cocktail parties and go back to their state capitals once in a while to pick up cash.
You know, one other question I have is that, do you think that there will be a shift within far-right politics, at least in some economic instances, to the left? Like, if you look at people like Richard Spencer, that kind of seems to be their play, is that essentially we need to be, you know, the racist version of, quote, Bernie Bros or something like that. Really embrace kind of social democratic economic policies like healthcare for all, UBI, things like that. Do you see that kind of being a tendency that's going to gain steam? Because he also kind of argues that so much of even the alt-right is still tied up within kind of like this cultural conservatism of libertarianism, free markets, you know, anything that's like, you know, a library's an evil communist institution because it's like a public institution, you know, stuff like that. I mean, these are kind of like what he would say, but I'm curious if you see that becoming more of a thing of certain segments of the far right really embracing quote unquote left, economic stances, trying to funnel people that way.
I think when the far right looks at government and it's talking about building a big government structure to serve the people, that could describe the Nazi Party in Germany. So just because you're talking about structures to serve the people doesn't mean you're talking about serving all the people, just the people who are deserving. The undeserving poor and the people who don't belong here will not be part of any system built by the right wing in the United States.
Anything else you want to talk about? Can you tell people where they can get a copy of this new book? Anything else we want to go over that we haven't covered?
The book is Trumping Democracy from Reagan to Alt-Right. I encourage you to buy it from an independent bookseller. There are lots of them, even online. And it follows the beginnings of this movement in the 1980s, especially with the French New Right, which is what a lot of the folks who are building the current right-wing street movements got their early lessons. So it's a book that'll help you understand how we got here step by step and help you prepare for the next round of trying to restore democratic civil society in the United States.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming on. Anything else you want to say?
One of the things that the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King used to talk about was the arc of history and how the arc of history bends towards justice. And I think that's true, but it's only true because so many of us grab that damn arc and bend it towards justice collectively. That's what changes society, and that's what bends the arc of history towards democracy and justice.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.